This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I am Melanie Guralnick, and I'll be reading from the April 2025 edition of Vanity Fair magazine. The first story is called Trial by Fire by Stuart Pally, as told to Anthony Brezikin. Los Angeles is said to have no seasons, but what it does have is what Joan Didion called the weather of catastrophe, of apocalypse. Photojournalist Stuart Pally turned his camera on this year's wildfires and shares his account of devastation and resilience. I was at my cabin in Joshua Tree right before the wind started up. The air was totally still. The sky was clear. The stars were sparkling. My gut was telling me that this was the calm before the storm. In this case, it was a firestorm. Over the years, I have photographed what the Santa Ana winds can do. The gales that regularly blast through Los Angeles are legendary. And, with barely a drop of rain in Southern California in 8 months, the land was tinderbox dry and primed for an inferno. That's exactly what happened the next day, many times over. The first of the two major conflagrations, the Palisades Fire, had erupted before I began driving my pickup back to L.A. on January 7th. By the time I got home to Newport Beach, dropped off my dog, got through traffic, and reached Santa Monica, it was 6:30 p.m. It was dark, and you could just see a glow on the northern horizon. Instead of rising high into the sky, the smoke column was leaned over sideways, pushed horizontal by the heavy winds. I had an anemometer, a portable wind gauge, and there were 45 miles per hour gusts at the beach where I was standing. My guess is that on the ridgetops it was blowing at 60 to 70 miles per hour. I thought, okay, aircraft aren't even going to be able to fly, at least till tomorrow. On one side was the Pacific, but cresting those hills was another ocean, this one made of flames. The wind blew sparks over the peaks. It was literally a wave of fire crashing down the hill. I shot the fire with the Santa Monica Pier in the foreground. Palm fronds and street signs were flying out into the water. My face was red from standing on the edge of the surf because all the sand coming off of the beach was sandblasting me. Then the Eaton Fire started just east of L.A., near Pasadena, in middle-class Altadena. By the time I got there, the chaos looked like a war zone. The visibility was maybe 25 feet. There were spot fires and embers in a park, which people were trying to put out themselves. Large branches had come down everywhere. I had to push open my truck door with both arms because there was so much wind pressure keeping it shut. There were fire engines everywhere, people walking down the street with bags, loads of cars backed up. I knew that a lot of people, including people I knew and cared about, might be losing their homes that night. I drove by a senior care home that had just been evacuated. They got nearly 200 people onto city buses and were gone by the time I got there. But I saw empty hospital gurneys and beds just rolling down the road in the wind. The mattresses were blowing off and getting wrapped around palm trees, which were igniting on top, throwing embers off, and starting more spot fires downwind. I saw the crew of one Los Angeles County fire engine trying to put water on a home that was ablaze. It was already a total loss, but they were trying to stop it from igniting the neighboring homes. Even a fire engine with its high-pressure deck gun shooting a torrent of water was like pissing in the wind at that point. My goal with this fire photography is for people to be better prepared, for them to take the evacuation seriously, and maybe, beforehand, clear brush to fortify their homes. I hope it could help make firefighters' jobs easier in educating the public. Safety and respect are important to me. I stay out of the way of first responders, and when I returned to photograph residents returning to where their homes used to be, I didn't photograph any homeowners unless I had their permission. This has been a terrible tragedy. We have to be realistic about the risk of where we've built, because these fires will happen again. I am going to do my best to describe this brilliant photographer's work. So the first one covers two pages, and it is taken in what I believe is nighttime, but with these fires it made the day look night, and he's standing on the beach. You can see the water washing up, and in the background, just past the lights of Santa Monica, everything looks to be torched, kind of like birthday candles on a cake. And the water nearest to the camera looks bloody. It's really red. And in the sky, it's a hazy yellow with very black, big clouds, along with a lighter set. And here is the caption for that photo, which I probably should have read first. The Palisades fire burns on Tuesday evening, January 7th. I took this photo looking northwest from the Pacific Ocean in Santa Monica. You can see the pier in the distance, with a red lamp illuminating the waves. The next photo is a nighttime photo, and here is the caption. Hundreds of embers fly off of decorative mini palm trees at a McDonald's during the early hours of the Eaton fire in Altadena. So you can see the big M McDonald's sign, and if you've ever seen welding, what happens when you weld, it flies off a bunch of sparks. And so this looks like, I don't know, 100 people are welding at the same time. It's just incredible. They come out as like orange lines in the sky. There's just thousands of them. The next picture has two firemen working, and they are putting up the hose to their truck. The caption says, Los Angeles County firefighters from Engine 233 pull hose from their engine to protect structures in Altadena. And it's super dark there because of all the smoke, and you can see the red lights on at the top in the very front of the fire truck. And the men are wearing hard hats that have illuminated lights on them. And there is a man on top of the fire truck helping line up the hose for the man on the ground. The next photo looks like it's a black and white, but I don't think it is because headlights are being used to illuminate everything, and it's just pretty dark, spooky looking. You can see some trees that haven't been burned, but right underneath them, one looks to be a Volvo, the other one totally unrecognizable, and they've been completely burned out. And here's what the caption says. Burned cars and skeletal trees in the historic Pacific Palisades north of Sunset Boulevard. This was the night of Thursday, January 9, 2 days after the fires erupted. The entire block was destroyed, and there was no electricity, so the only lighting was from my truck's headlights. Although the fire had passed by now, charred branches continued to fall from the trees, and toxic debris smoldered in the cavities left by the homes that had been consumed. The area was silent. Even first responders were gone. Here, there was simply nothing left to protect. The next picture is also consuming two pages. I'm going to read the caption first. A drone image of a residential block in Altadena that had been incinerated by the Eaton fire. This was Thursday, January 30th, nearly 3 weeks after the fires had begun. Just a few days before, it had rained for the first time in months, dousing the last stubborn embers of the fires, but creating a gray sludge that covered much of what was left behind. Residents had been allowed to explore the remains of their homes, with the warning that asbestos, heavy metals, and other dangers were lurking in the wreckage. In the center of the frame, you can see an unblemished white car. That is likely an evacuee returning to inspect the ruins. In looking at this picture, there must be about 50 homes photographed from overhead. They're just squares on a lot with charred embers, just gray powder. All the cars are burned. You can see the streets still there. And yes, the white car is in a driveway and is definitely standing out compared to everything else. It almost doesn't look real. Here is the caption for the next picture. Contractors working for the Environmental Protection Agency examined the remains of a home in Altadena for hazardous substances on Friday, January 31. The crews, who wore full-body hazmat suits, hard hats, and respirators, which they had to change every time they visited a new property to avoid spreading contaminants, found asbestos fibers and unstable propane canisters. In this photo, you can see in the foreground that there is a pile of ash, and far away in the distance you see two men in the hazmat white suits, and they've got dark colored poles that they're using to pick through things. And the trees behind them are all charred, including a palm tree, which just the lower portion of the tree was charred. And there are blue skies. Here is the caption of the next picture. Not all civilians had protective gear. Here, William Hilliard sifts through the remains of his home in western Altadena on January 30th. He and his wife wore simple face masks as they dug through rubble in search of anything salvageable. Hilliard said he lived in Altadena for 30 years and barely had time to grab anything before fleeing. So William is wearing a purple shirt that's long-sleeved. He is holding a yellow long pole that probably is a rake or something. He's got some gloves on. He's bald and he's squinting into the sun, and his face mask is pulled down around his neck. And in the distance, everything is sort of grainy, but you can see that all of the trees are charred. And here is the caption for the last picture, which is a two-pager. A reverse of the opening image, this shot looks south from the ruins of the Palisades fire toward the glow of Santa Monica and its amusement park pier. This was Malibu on January 9th, 2 days after the fires broke out. Smoke obscured direct sunlight as gray overtook the region at dusk. The fire burned homes from the bluffs overlooking the coastline right down to the Pacific Ocean. So this entire photo is a kind of a pink tinge and silhouetted. So all of the burned and charred trees are silhouetted as you look down to the water. There is lights coming down from the fire right up to the beach, and where all the beach homes were is just piles of rubble. And you can see the lights of Santa Monica far off in the distance. That was Trial by Fire by Stuart Pally, as told to Anthony Bresnikan. The next story is called Style Driver by Rebecca Ford. Photographs by Camilla Akrins, styled by Leith Clark. Simone Ashley's parents supported her dream of being an actor when she was a teenager, but a few years later, they seemed to be watching the clock. When I was in my early 20s, they were still open to it, the actor says on a video call from her home in London. But I think, secretly, they were like, oh, when you hit 25, that's when you're going to have to get serious. I didn't really explain how much I wanted it and how hard I was working for it because I wanted the work to prove that I could do it. Then, when I, thankfully, could make a living off of doing this, I think they were just like, cool, she's fine. Fine doesn't do justice to Ashley's trajectory. By the time she was 25, she had a steady gig as a popular bubblegum-popping high schooler in sex education with Gillian Anderson. By 26, she'd broken out on the second season of Bridgerton as Kate Sharma, an independent young woman who'd rather race through the countryside on her horse than promenade around a ballroom waiting for a gentleman to ask her to dance. Now, Ashley has scored a plum role in F1, Brad Pitt's Formula One racing film, which roars into theaters in June. I'm really out to show such a range of things I can do, she says. Being dark-skinned, being a culturally specific woman in Hollywood, it's about finding the right kind of project where you just see the humanity in someone. Along the way, she has added all manner of things to her resume. She's appeared in an Nespresso commercial with George Clooney and became a L'Oreal Paris brand ambassador, as well as a fashion it girl who wore a sequined midnight blue Prabble Garonne gown and purple eyeshadow that evoked a young Cher to the Met Gala last year. Ashley's parents, Latha and Gunasekaran Pillai, were Tamil academics who emigrated from southern India to Surrey, England, before she and her older brother, Sean, were born. Ashley demonstrated an aptitude for singing early on, so her parents arranged for lessons, which led to musical theater. Then I watched a bunch of Quentin Tarantino movies, and I just got the bug, she says. I explored film and decided that this was what I wanted to do. Ashley had enough of a rebellious streak to leave school at 16 to pursue acting and spent some of her teens with relatives in and out of Los Angeles. At 18, she started to model and try out for roles, and later honed her acting skills at performing art schools back in London. Any time I got rejected or told I couldn't do something, it felt strongly external, she says. I never let it hit my heart. That feeling of believing in myself always outweighed any external denial I may have faced. With Kate, Ashley brought a more modern protagonist to Bridgerton, a sharp, quick-witted outsider who also happened to look stunning in jewel-toned gowns. It turned out to be just the right combination to bedazzle Anthony Bridgerton, played by Jonathan Bailey, and the two of them ended the season as Viscount and Viscountess. Bridgerton raised Ashley's profile, but she was careful not to get confined to the genre. Along with signing on for F1, a movie she calls one of the coolest experiences of my life, she appeared as one of Ariel's sisters in 2023's live-action The Little Mermaid, took on the psychological thriller This Tempting Madness, and starred in the rom-com Picture This. In Picture This, which came out in March on Prime Video, Ashley plays Pia, an aspiring photographer who's told by a spiritual guru that she'll meet the love of her life in her next 5 dates. I always wanted to be the leading lady in a rom-com, she says, and to represent more women that look like me as that kind of Bridget Jones character. Along with displaying her charm and comedic chops, Picture This gave Ashley her first executive producer credit, which let her ensure that her own background was accurately represented in the women she played. We celebrate her heritage, she says. The joy and the comedy is also in celebrating the culture. Now, Ashley is having a homecoming of sorts by returning to Bridgerton for its 4th season, which will air next year. This time around, Kate is a new mother, so there are fresh waters for Ashley to dive into. There was so much drama and volatility before, she says. Now, when I play her, she's much softer, which is super fun. Ashley is also recording her debut album for Universal Music with producer Fraser T. Smith, who has worked with Adele and Drake, among others. She describes the album as pop with some R&B references and says she's been inspired by the likes of Sade and Alicia Keys. She hopes the album could lead to starring in a movie musical someday. She'd also love to play an action hero, a Lara Croft type. It's really good to lean into having fun with it and not taking it all too seriously and taking opportunity when it comes. Ashley has always admired the way Dev Patel has shaped his career. I definitely don't want to be playing characters that feel overly stereotypical, she says. The doors haven't always been open to her. She's been in auditions where it was clear she wouldn't get the role because of her skin color. I've been very close to getting big, life-changing roles, but losing them to a blonde actress, she says. This is why it's so amazing how supportive women of color in Hollywood are. We all kind of speak the same language, and we all understand that kind of hurdle. In low moments, Ashley sometimes calls up Wicked star Cynthia Erivo, who became a friend and mentor after they met on the Ellen DeGeneres show in 2022. She's just done it and proved that women like us get bums in seats. The first photo of Simone Ashley is in black and white. It's very close up. She has her chin resting on her knee. She's wearing white stockings that have little black polka dots. She hardly has any makeup on. She has incredible big, big brown eyes. And her earring that you can see because she's kind of at an angle is A feather with a pear-shaped diamond hanging down. They're stunning earrings. They're all pavé diamonds, and those are courtesy of Boucheron. Her dress is by Chanel, and her bralette is by Etro, which you can't even really see. The next picture of Simone is in color, and she is laying in a bed, looking as if she's taking off an earring, which you cannot see. Her black hair is spread over the pillow and is slightly curled at the end. She has heavy cat eyeliner on, which looks really good with her face, and she has very good looking eyebrows too that are maybe enhanced. But other than that, really no makeup. And she's just in white sheets and a white top. She is photographed at the Lanesborough Hotel in London on February 2. The next photo of Simone is of her lying on top of the bed, on top of the sheets in a hotel room. There is an Italian gold type of oval mirror on the right. The lamp is turned on her bedside table, and there are kind of taupe-colored shiny curtains behind her, behind the bed, that is. She is wearing a brown, very soft-looking sweater and high-waisted underwear, and you can see her thigh, and her black hair is longer than I thought. It's really pretty, and it's covering the bed. So that would be the clothing is by Fendi, ring by Chanel Fine Jewelry. The next photo is in black and white. She must be in the bathroom because it looks like a shower curtain near her, and then there's one behind her, and she's in a white robe, and she has her head up with her eyes closed like she's totally in bliss, and her hair is long and beautiful. The last picture of Simone is of her sitting at a table and chairs in probably a hotel room. She is wearing a white shirt over a very tiny white bralette that has the Gucci logo on it in white. She has a half-eaten hamburger and fries and a Coke on the table in front of her. There's some carnations in a vase, and behind her are very, very classy looking chandeliers and striped curtains and gold leaf furniture. That was Style Driver by Rebecca Ford, photographs by Camilla Akrons, and styled by Leif Clark. The next story is called God Complex. Silicon Valley was once driven by a godless chase for growth. Now the new religion is religion, by Zoe Bernard. It's mid-October in San Francisco, and a crowd of 200 or so congregants, some seated in pews, others standing below cathedral windows at the back, bow their heads in prayer. Over cranberry apple cosmos and plates of Burmese food served by black-shirted waiters, a DJ plays a thumping soundtrack of remixed worship music. This is not a church service or even a Bible study. It is, instead, an entirely new kind of event in Silicon Valley. We are here to listen in on a conversation between Dr. Francis S. Collins, the former director of the National Institutes of Health and leader of the Human Genome Project, and Gary Tan, the president and CEO of Silicon Valley's influential startup incubator, Y Combinator, which has hatched thousands of tech companies with a combined valuation of more than $600 billion. The event is called Code and Cosmos, and its underlying thesis is that the fields of science and technology, once considered diametrically opposed to religion and spirituality, might converge with the teachings of the Bible. In other words, business networking for the spiritually curious. What is the real basis of morality? Collins asks the crowd. Why am I here? What happens after I die? Collins, a thin, owlish man, gazes solemnly at the crowd, which already seems to have a sense of where this is going. Science, he says, can't really give you an answer. But there is another answer to these questions, and it has to do with one Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom Collins encountered as a 20-something medical student grappling with the limits of atheism. Ever since, he said, I've never really hit a situation where what I know as a rigorous scientist and what I believe as a Christ-centered Christian are in conflict. That this conversation is taking place not at a church, but in Tan's home, which, incidentally, happens to be a converted church a stone's throw from Dolores Park, may seem, as Tan tells us from the stage, a little bit unusual. There was a time, Tan says, when such a gathering would be, quote, maybe even reviled in San Francisco. Many in the room, myself included, remember vividly the period to which Tan is referring. It was a time, not so very long ago, mostly in the 2010s, when Silicon Valley cultivated a stance of pointed hostility not only toward conservatism, but to the Protestant doctrines that underpin much of American life. For many years, the running joke, popularized by the HBO show Silicon Valley, was that in the Bay Area, Christianity was, quote, borderline illegal. Of course, there have been Christians in Silicon Valley. They just knew better than to advertise their faith. This is to say, the Christians were effectively in hiding. And one specific place that they were hiding was, according to Tan, on a spreadsheet made up of Christians in tech, which was passed around for years among a dozen or so of the techno-faithful. One of them was Trey Stevens, co-founder of the defense tech company Anduril and a partner at Founders Fund, the venture capital firm co-founded by Peter Thiel. Stevens, like Tan, has lately been speaking publicly about his faith in the context of Silicon Valley. He has hosted a Bible study reflecting on the teachings of René Girard, a French philosopher popular in certain libertarian-leaning tech circles, spoken at his church about the connection between Christianity and innovation, and written, in what seems a slightly contorted interpretation of the gospel, about how basic venture investing principles are an exemplar of divine forgiveness. Near trays of sticky rice laid out on white tablecloths stood a woman with substantially false eyelashes, who, when I asked if she worked in tech, eyed my press credentials nervously. I'm an investor, she said, in tech. When I prodded her further on what sector she invested in, she doubled down. I told you, she barked, I invest in tech. Tech! She opened up only slightly when, to make conversation as we stood waiting to speak to Tan, I asked if she was a Christian. Yes, in fact she was and had been for many years. And while she did not feel, in response to my suggestion, that she was unable to speak openly about her faith, it was a topic she avoided bringing up in professional settings, until the past year or so, when she began to sense a change. That's all the time we have for this story, which was God Complex. Silicon Valley was once driven by a godless chase for growth. Now the new religion is religion. By Zoe Bernard. That concludes today's readings from Vanity Fair magazine. This has been Melanie Guralnick for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.